T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
On the phone with me for this segment, I have labor and employment attorney Christine Alani. She is managing partner at the Sacramento office of law firm Sifar Shaw. And we're going to be talking about some of the new labor laws that have been signed by Governor Brown. Thank you for joining me today, Christina. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. Thrilled to be here.
The results of California's 2018 legislative session are now in, and Governor Brown has finished approving and vetoing several bills. Quite a few significant new employment laws will take effect January 1st of 2019, posing new interpretation and compliance challenges for employers. And we're going to be talking about many of those bills. Several of those bills were sexual harassment bills that will affect employers. But first, specifically, let's talk about the Human Trafficking Awareness Bill. Tell us about that.
Sure. The Human Trafficking Awareness Bill is actually a fairly narrow bill, but with, you know, a good purpose to be served. It requires hotel and motel employers, which does not include bed and breakfast inns, just hotels and motels, to provide, starting January 1st, 2020, and once every 2 years after that, at least 20 minutes of interactive human trafficking awareness training to employees who are likely to interact with human trafficking victims.
Okay, next let's talk about the sexual harassment omnibus bill. That's SB 1300.
Yeah, omnibus in terms of it does a little bit of everything. First of all, what it does is this bill adds a section to the government code that declares the purpose of harassment laws is to provide all Californians with equal opportunity to succeed in the workplace. And it expressly affirms or rejects judicial decisions that it names the cases by name that were regarding a plaintiff's burden of proof on the degree to which working conditions must have been altered for a harassment claim to lie. They also have to deal with what is sufficiently severe or pervasive to constitute harassment. One of the cases that this new statute discusses, the statute is affirming the California Supreme Court's rejection of the stray remarks doctrine, basically that, you know, if someone makes a remark related to a protected class, but it's not in relation to an actual employment decision, it still could be, you know, considered in the context of a harassment case. And then also disapproving the use of a case to support different standards for hostile work environment harassment depending on the type of workplace. For example, if, you know, it's someplace where you think people would be speaking more freely than other sorts of workplaces, you can't, you know, say that that should be subject to a different standard for harassment. And then the final case that this new statute mentions is in the context of the statute affirms that hostile work environment cases involve issues that are not determinable on paper. In other words, you can't resolve hostile work environment cases just through motions. You need to have testimony and assess the witnesses and their credibility. That's just one of the things that SB 1300 does. 1300 also expands an employer's potential liability under the Fair Employment and Housing Act for acts of non-employees to all forms of unlawful harassment. Before, it was limited to sexual harassment. Now it's extended to all forms of unlawful harassment, race, national origin, et cetera, in addition to on the basis of sex. It prohibits employers from requiring an employee to sign as a condition of employment, getting a raise or getting a bonus, a release of Fair Employment and Housing Act claims or rights, or a document that prohibits disclosure of information about unlawful acts in the workplace, which would include, you know, requiring the employee to sign a non-disparagement agreement. That provision, at least, expressly says that it doesn't apply to settlement agreements that were negotiated to resolve FEHA claims, Fair Employment and Housing claims, filed in court before administrative agencies ADR, in alternative dispute resolution, or through the employer's internal complaint process, but it still does raise a lot of questions as to when does it apply, could it apply in some context when I don't think it would, and if I'm an employer, it's a little scary to figure out how that provision will play out. Even more, SB 1300 prohibits a prevailing defendant, a defendant that is victorious in litigation, from being awarded attorney's fees and costs unless the court finds the action was frivolous, unreasonable, or groundless when it was brought, or that the plaintiff continued to litigate after it clearly became the case that the case was frivolous, unreasonable, or groundless. And then finally, the final significant development out of SB 1300 is it actually seems kind of silly in calling it significant, but it authorizes employers to provide bystander intervention training to employees. And we say this is significant because, it's another training provision. It's not a training obligation, however. It authorizes this bystander intervener training, but it does not require it. So it really is, an omnibus bill. It did a little bit of everything in the way of sexual harassment and related harassment obligations.
Okay, now tell us about SB 3109. It apparently bans waivers of rights to testify. What does that actually mean?
SB 3109 was one of the three bills that we saw this session that related to what you can and cannot require in an agreement with somebody. So SB 3109 makes void and unenforceable a provision that waives a party's right to testify in a legal proceeding if that testimony is required or requested by a court order, a subpoena, or an administrative or legislative request. And this applies if the legal proceeding is regarding criminal conduct or sexual harassment on the part of the other contracting party or that party's agents or employees. So basically, if you entered into an agreement in which you agreed that you would not testify about some sort of criminal conduct or sexual harassment that the other party to this agreement engaged in, that provision of that agreement, say if it was a settlement agreement, that one provision of the settlement agreement would not be enforceable.
Okay. Now, there's also a bill that requires sexual harassment education by talent agencies. Why talent agencies? I think it's pretty obvious, but what was their reasoning for that?
That's a good question. I think it was, attempting to get at one, potential abuses and abuses, two, a potentially vulnerable workforce in certain respects, and number three, it actually goes even broader than that. What it does is it requires the talent agencies to provide educational materials on sexual harassment prevention, retaliation, and reporting resources to adult artists, parents, or legal guardians of minors from 14 to 17 years old and age eligible minors with those materials. And then it also, interestingly, for adult model artists, requires the talent agency to provide materials on nutrition and eating disorders. So, really providing them with the information and the resources for these issues that might affect them, likely quite some of it coming out of, the Me Too movement and, us hearing about some abuses that, we all read about some of them in the news that some models exposed or some models stated that they were exposed to in the course of their work, and the fact that, the talent agency modeling contracting industry is not your traditional employer-employee relationship where the employees, are given sexual harassment policies, required to be given sexual harassment training, and supervisory employees required to be given that training. So this is very likely an attempt to get that information to this population that doesn't have as easy access to it.
Okay, now for just regular employers in general, the scope of required sexual harassment training, is that going to be expanded?
Yes, it is. So the way it was expanded was it now applies to all employees of employers with five or greater employees. So if you're an employer that has at least five employees, you need to provide at least, you need to provide 2 hours of sexual harassment training to supervisory employees, all supervisory employees, and 1 hour of training to non-supervisory employees. And it also states that that training can be done in segments. It doesn't necessarily have to be done all at once, which is a nice clarification. And it also contains provisions regarding training that you must provide to seasonal or temporary employees and to migrant employees as well, who are not previously addressed, relevant to your earlier conversation about, well, what is this going to cost or what could it cost employers? Here, at least, this bill requires the Department of Fair Employment and Housing to develop and put out online training videos, both the 2 hour training and the 1 hour training, and to make those courses available on the DFEH's website, as well as make available existing informational posters, fact sheets, and to make those available in multiple languages so that employers who want to access the training materials that way, rather than going out and hiring a private company or developing their own, can do that.
Okay. Now, AB 1976, lactation location. Tell us about that.
That one is one that's a little bit of a victory for employers, even though, providing a space that is adequate for employees who need to express milk, who, need to lactate, is something that I know that all employers want to be able to accommodate. Certain employers, though, just by the very nature of the business or the location of the business, have a hard time providing a, stand-alone, dedicated space for it. And one of the bills that had been pending on this subject would have required that employers provide a lactation room that has certain features, including access to a sink and a refrigerator in close proximity to the employee's workplace, would have required a lactation accommodation policy, and would have required the employer to maintain accommodation request records for 3 years and allow the employee and the labor commissioner to access those records. And it would have also, deemed the denial of the break time or space a failure to provide a rest period under Labor Code Section 226.7, which is, one of the most litigated, sections of law these days that we're seeing. So it's great that the governor vetoed that one. He signed into law AB 1976, which just requires employers to make reasonable efforts to provide a room or a location that is not a bathroom for lactation. It authorizes a temporary lactation location if certain locations or certain conditions are met, and it provides a narrow undue hardship exemption. So whereas the statute, as it reads right now, states that employers must make reasonable efforts to provide a room or a location that is not a toilet stall, come January 1st, 2019, the statute will read that employers must make reasonable efforts to provide a room or location that is not a bathroom. So you can't just give women a, stool in a bathroom for lactation purposes. Now you need to actually provide them a space that's separate from the bathroom.
Okay. SB 1412 has to do with criminal history. Tell us about that.
That one is one of multiple criminal history bills that went through the legislature this year, but the only one that survived. It's going to require, as of January 1st, 2019, employers to consider only particular convictions, which are defined in the bill, that are relevant to the job when screening applicants using a criminal background check. The, background check provisions are highly specialized. So, we always recommend that when it comes to those sorts of requirements, you check with a specialist and make sure that you're doing everything properly.
Okay, now there's also a new bill that deals with the number of women on boards. Tell us about that bill.
That bill is really interesting because it has been talked about recently in the context of of constitutionality. At its foundation, though, what it does is it's SB 826. It requires California-based publicly held corporations to have on their board of directors, each of their boards of directors, at least one female. And that's female is defined for purposes of the new statute as people who self-identify as women, regardless of their designated sex at birth. And the deadline for compliance with that requirement that you have at least one female on your board of directors is December 31st, 2019. And the bill even recognizes that a corporation might need to increase its authorized number of directors to comply with this requirement. Then from there, the bill imposes minimum seat requirements that the corporation must fill with women that are proportional to the total number of seats on the board by December 31st, 2021. The bill requires the Secretary of State to publish a report by July of next year, 2019, of the number of corporations whose principal executive offices are in California and have at least one female director, and then an annual report beginning March of 2020 that details the number of corporations that complied with requirements 2019 and you know, going on the prior year, and who moved their headquarters in or out of California, and who were subject to these provisions during the prior year but are no longer publicly traded, you know, essentially so that the public knows what companies are complying with this requirement and what aren't. The penalties can be rather stiff for failure to comply with this new law as well. For each director's seat that is not held by a female during at least a portion of the calendar year when by law it should have been, the corporation will be subject to a $100,000 fine for the first violation and a $300,000 fine for further violations. And corporations that fail to timely file board member information with the Secretary of State will also be subject to a $100,000 fine.
So it sounds like a lot of extra paperwork in the future.
Yes, the legislature does sometimes do that to employers, that's for sure.
Okay, now are there any other important bills that you think need to be mentioned?
I think that those really are the big ones. I don't know, we didn't talk about SB 820, which is the third of the new laws that have to do with, you know, contractual obligations or prohibitions on contractual obligations when it comes to sexual harassment. What SB 820 does is it makes void any provision that prevents the disclosure of information related to civil or administrative complaints of sexual assault, sexual harassment, and workplace harassment or discrimination based on sex. It does, however, authorize provisions that preclude the disclosure of the amount paid in a settlement and that protect the claimant's identity and any fact that could reveal the claimant's identity as long as the claimant has requested anonymity and the opposing party is not a government agency or a public official. So we always, you know, we want to look at the three bills, SB 1300, SB 3109, and SB 820, all sort of as one package of if you're an employer and, you know, you're subject to litigation or you're entering into severance agreements or you, as a matter of course, do, you know, settlement agreements regarding demands or, you know, anything of that sort, you want to look at these three bills, these three new statutes, and make sure that you're not running afoul of any of their requirements if you're asking employees, for example, to release FEHA claims or rights or to keep anything confidential and, you know, criminal conduct, sexual harassment, or discrimination are at issue.
Now, what do you suggest employers do to make sure that they comply with all these new bills? How can they do that?
Well, I think absolutely paying attention to, you know, updates like the ones that my firm has put out that list all of the new requirements that are going to come into play January 1st. You know, either if you're, you know, a self-help kind of employer, reading the new statutes and analyzing them, but also for some of these, like I said, for, you know, criminal history inquiries, there's some new immigration provisions. There are some really highly specialized areas of law that are affected that I would say absolutely you need to consult with an attorney who specializes in those areas of law. I even consult with my internal immigration and criminal history and background check experts when questions of those areas come up. With the confidentiality provisions, again, those can be pretty complicated. So I would absolutely say, you know, reach out to your attorneys with whom you usually work, reach out to us, we're happy to help, and make sure you are looking at the training requirements and that you are getting a plan ready to go so that you are training employees within the time frames required and the types of employees that now are covered, you know, not just supervisory employees, not just non-supervisory employees, but also your, you know, if you have migrant workers, if you have contract or temporary employees, put a process in place to start training them timely and keeping records of your training for them. And then if you are an employer that is in a specific industry that may have been affected by any of the industry-specific bills, make sure you take a look at those and get prepared for those new developments that will, for the most part, though there were a couple of laws that had urgency clauses attached and went into effect immediately, for the most part, all of these new laws will go into effect January 1st of 2019.
Okay, Christina Lani, managing partner at the Sacramento office of law firm Sifar Shaw, and we've been talking about some of the new labor laws that are going to be going into effect coming up in 2019. Thank you very much, Christina, for the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a great day.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.